So tonight's talk is going to be about the role of the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity in the role of a mature, integrated practice. And specifically, like, where might these practices take us? How they might transform us? And the potential is substantial with these particular practices. And these practices are absolutely essential to laying a ground for our the practice that I think most people do more of, which is the traditional Vipassana practice, the traditional meditation practice. This actually is a critical foundation for the Vipassana practice, particularly once you start to get to a certain level of seeing and experiencing in that practice. So the other night I had quoted the historical Buddha when he had said that he knew of no other single thing than a well-trained mind in leading to happiness. And he knew of no other single thing other than an untrained mind in leading to misery and dissatisfaction. And I've always thought that was kind of an extraordinary statement from him, because if you think of the breadth of this practice, I mean, all of the different things that this practice encompasses, for him to pick out that issue, you know, the training of the mind is the single most important thing, for me, really frames things. It's not a particular state of mind, because we don't acquire the state of mind unless we go through training, which ties with the foundational idea in Buddhist practice that things just don't happen by themselves. They happen as a result of conditions. And if we can understand what those conditions are, and through practice and understanding, modify the conditions in our life and the way we practice, then certain things happen. It takes us down the path in a particular way. And if we don't do that, if we don't have either the understanding or the practice, then the results that the Buddha, I think, promised don't occur. So, interestingly, in the last 3 years, as the result of having this little boy come into my life, my grandson, I seem to understand this much more. And maybe it's that I understand it viscerally much more now, and that more of my understanding before was kind of like operationally, or I wouldn't say philosophically, but more operationally and mechanistically. So he's 3 years old right now, and in the last year we've been working with something. And you know, little kids, everybody here who's had a child or a grandchild or been around children know that they go through all these different stages, basically, of testing and learning what the world is about and what works and what doesn't work. And so he was going through this stage where when he would come over to my house, which is a lot, he would kind of rough up my two little dogs. And, you know, like, just out of nowhere, you know, the dogs would be up there and, you know, very excited to see him and everything. And, you know, he'd pop one of them on the nose, you know, or he'd have some little stick that he brought in from outside. Or I have two bamboo walking sticks that were made for me by a really close friend who's now not alive anymore. And so he likes to play with those. So, you know, he'd be running around and, you know, doing this, and, you know, he'd pop one of them in the head, you know. So I started off working with him on this, you know, by saying, oh, you know, Ko, no, we don't want to do that, you know. And then I started thinking about it, and I thought, well, no, let's do a different approach, you know. Let's see if I can be more in tune with this practice, you know. So the next time he popped one, and he really popped them well, and he popped them so hard that they kind of didn't want to come back, that we sat down on the floor together, and I had them come over, and they really loved this little guy, and they sat down, and then I started petting them, and I started talking to them, and I said, how Mom loves you? He said, you know how Daddy loves you? Yeah. You know how Poppy loves you? Yeah, I'm Poppy. I said, well, Obi and Kenobi, they love you that way, And, so, we should really love Obi and Kenobi, And then he started petting Obi and Kenobi. So this is kind of the theme that I started working with him. And whenever he gets lays down on the bed, they want to be, right with him. Like, if I go in the other room, they don't want to go with me. They want to stay with him, right? So they would get up on the bed, and I would say to him, you see how much Obi and Kenobi love you? They want to stay with you. They don't want to go with me, And so now, this is over about a year, just spontaneously now. We'll just be in the house doing nothing, and he'll walk over and start, petting one of them. Or he'll frequently, when he comes in, the very first thing he wants to do is run from my front door into the kitchen, and I have a drawer where there's like treats, And he'll want to go get those treats and give one to each of the boys. But then the really interesting part is the smaller one of the dogs, his name is Kenobi, always takes his little treat into the front room and eats it on a rug in there. And so Koa, every single time, will follow him into the front room and lay down next to him, and sit there and watch him eat that. And every single time, he'll turn around and look at me, and he's just beaming. He's so excited to be with that little dog and just being with that little dog eating, And I've started doing a similar thing with him with trees. So we go for a lot of walks, and we have a lot of redwood trees where I live. And so, I'll just pick out a random big redwood tree, and we'll go over and say, hi, Mr. Tree, And then he'll say it in his little voice, hi, Mr. Tree, and how are you today? How are you today? I hope you're good. And then we'll sit there and just examine the tree, and, with these old redwoods, a lot of the wood is kind of loose, and if you pull it back, which he likes to do frequently, there's bugs and things, so it's very exciting. So we can spend a lot of time, and then when we leave, we say, oh, okay, goodbye, Mr. Tree, goodbye, Mr. Tree. And so now he's kind of like spontaneously now, like relating to trees in a different way. So I hope everyone at this point hasn't thought that this has become ridiculously simple, okay? But, for me, it underscores the idea that, I think it's easy to say, well, what does training have to do with kindness? What does training have to do with compassion or joy? And what it has to do with it is that, as a general rule, unfortunately, I think it's a truth, that for most people, most of the time, this kind of expansive kindness and compassion and joy are not your default settings. When you're challenged in some way, particularly with a difficult situation, we tend to respond with other emotions. And so it really is a question, and Buddha was very clear about this, that with these particular states of mind that we're going to talk about, that it actually is a training or a retraining, so that first we study and develop like an intellectual understanding and framework of what it is and how it works and how it fits together with the other practices. Then we actually practice with it. We do trial and error and see what works and doesn't work, and what does loving kindness, not kindness, but loving kindness, feel like, as opposed to other things. what are the pitfalls? And then we start getting an inkling of what these states of mind are and how they work. And then we start noticing that intuitively we start changing. Rather than like being in a situation and saying, well, something happened and I'm obviously angry, so you know, I want to practice metta now and I want to be kind to this person, which is important. I mean, that's a stage, you know, it's quite important. But you start to notice that just spontaneously that this starts to happen. You know, you don't have to think about being kind or compassionate or feeling joy where before you wouldn't have felt that way. And it's because you've been training. You know? So what we'll do tonight is talk about what the Brahma Viharas are, the impact they have on us, the two ways we practice them. We practice them as a meditation practice, which is an intensive practice, actually a concentration practice, and then in daily life or in relationship with experiences off the cushion. And those are two actually fairly different ways of practicing. And so that'll be kind of the range of what we're going to go over tonight. So what are the so-called Brahma Viharas? And there are four of them. And as I said earlier, there's what is commonly referred to as loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. The first three, fundamentally from a Buddhist perspective, are actually emotions. And the fourth one is a quality of mind, equanimity. And so there are many ways to think of this, but one way to think of it is that the first three are basically, from a Western perspective, like heart qualities. Like we say, we'll speak from your heart. These are the qualities that we're talking about. And the fourth one, equanimity, is this balanced state of mind that is kind of overseeing everything. And as the talks, as we proceed forward in the week, there will be specific talks on each one of these. The talks will include the fact that there are things that you need to watch for because you're practicing compassion or sympathetic joy or loving kindness, and in the midst of it, it turns out you're not practicing that. You're practicing something else. So there's what's called a near and a far enemy. So equanimity is one of the plays a role in that, in helping keep the way we use these very powerful states of mind in balance, in a flexible balance. Okay. So the significant part about these states of mind, as traditionally defined, is they are defined as unlimited, unconditional, and unmeasurable. Okay. Unlimited, unconditional, unmeasurable. Now, you know, we hear a lot of expansive descriptions in Buddhist practice, but if you think about those three words, they're extraordinary, right? That you would have a type of kindness or compassion or joy that is unbounded, that there's no boundary on it. Or you would have a type of kindness or compassion that has no precondition to it at all and no expectation. So there's, if you're actually feeling and practicing and cultivating these three, there's no attachment of any kind. You're not doing it because you're going to get something back from another person. You're not even doing it because you're going to get something out of it, even though you are. So they are unconditional states of mind. That's what we're trying to cultivate. And they're unmeasurable because if they're unbounded and unconditional, there's no way that you could possibly measure them. They're so big. You know? So one of the descriptions that's frequently used for metta or loving kindness is the care and concern that a mother has for her child. And if you go out into the garden back behind the kitchen up the hill, there's the most beautiful statue there of the Mother Mary and holding a baby. I'm assuming, since this was a Catholic nunnery, that it's the Mother Mary and the baby Jesus. But if you look at that without any of that, just look at it, it's one of the most extraordinary statues. And I look at that thing and I just melt, you know. I mean, you really understand, you know, what it means. And so that's a statue, and we've got these words, these big words, you know, unlimited, unconditional, unmeasurable. So, like, what does that look like actually in real life? And for me, there was a woman I knew. I still know her, but I used to see her all the time, and she had a child, and the child was given one of these, quote, borderline diagnoses, and it's the kind of borderline diagnoses that you don't want your child to have. And if this, when this starts getting in medical charts, and particularly if it gets in a school chart, it changes the life of your child for the rest of their life, okay? So I think I can honestly say that she refused to accept that, you know? And it wasn't like just this blind irrationality. She's extraordinary in terms of like researching this out and really knowing her child and being able to point why she thought that what everybody was saying was wrong. And so over a period of, I don't know, maybe 10 years, I saw the love of a mother for that child that was extraordinary in the sense of what she was willing to do. You know, the lengths that she was willing to go for that child's welfare, for that child's future. And it overrode her self-consciousness, her self-judgment, insecurities that she had, limitations that she thought she had. And that little boy graduated last year from UC Davis with a BA. He's 21 and he's in a master's program now. Okay? She's right. You know. But absent that love, it would have never happened. And I want to be really clear about the point of this story, because it's not that metta makes you go to extraordinary lengths, although it does sometimes. What it does do is what it did with her, is that metta transforms your relationship to yourself. And that as this begins to develop in these forms of compassion that are these much larger ideas of compassion and much larger ideas of kindness, what they do is that they, in the beginning, override the things that would normally hold us back. They override our sense of inadequacy. They override our sense of self-consciousness. They override our sense of limitation. And they give you a courage, which is arising out of this deep care and concern, to do things that you normally wouldn't do. And not in a reckless way, but in a way that you can actually see that you might be able to do that. And in circumstances where you wouldn't do it because you would be self-conscious or feel like, you know, I'm inadequate, or judge yourself, and all the stuff we do to ourselves all the time, it overrides it. It puts it aside, and you go forward. And so that's one of the indications that when these states of mind start working, this is what you start seeing. I mean, you start noticing that you're willing to take on things that you didn't take on before, that you spontaneously extend yourself to someone in a way that you wouldn't have done 2, 3, 4, 5 years before. And this doesn't happen quickly. You know, the Buddha said that this was a gradual path, And this really takes a while, but it really does start to happen. And I know in my own case, the combination of my having just an absolute belief in this practice and where it can take you, and through working with these specific practices, I would have never imagined that I would be sitting here with Diane and Rich tonight teaching when I first started this. Even when I first started trying to create Sim with a number of other people, I would have never imagined I would be sitting here. I would have never imagined that some of very, very difficult and painful relationships that have been damaged in my life, that to some significant degree, to the degree that I'm capable at this point in my life, that I would be able to heal them. And so, sitting here right now, you know, our ordinary mind defines us in a particular way, and it's highly conditional. It's based on trauma in our life and our family of origin and our self-image, all these things. And these qualities of mind are beyond that limited mind state that we're normally operating in. So if you understand the mechanism, it is miraculous, but it's not miraculous in the sense that it's not understandable, or that there's some intervening force that's making it happen. It's happening as a result of our cultivating these deep intentions in ourself, and then those intentions start to express themselves in our thoughts and our emotions and our conduct. Okay. Is this working so far? Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think is possible, what I know is possible with these. And if some of these seem like, I haven't had that experience, or they seem like, you know, like a little far out, okay, I would say just relax, just enjoy yourself, whatever sounds reasonable, accept it. And I'm going to stress the phrase that you haven't experienced yet, because I absolutely believe that everything I talk about tonight, that with sufficient practice, all of us can begin to experience these things. We first of all begin getting little glimpses of them, and then we start actually having stronger, more tangible experiences, and then we start to have like real openings where you know the truth of this, and then once you feel that, you know, you never turn back. You know, so. Okay, so the first thing that happens over a considerable period of time, and this is in conjunction with our Vipassana practice, but without these practices, the degree to which it happens is significantly different, is something significant, a couple of things, three things happen, which are quite significant in terms of our relationship to the reactivity we have to events. Okay, so, you know, all of us, if I picked anyone out in this room, I could say, tell me the things that you're most reactive to. And there wouldn't be a person in the room who wouldn't be able to answer that question, right? Absolutely, okay. So as you start to do these practices, the first thing that happens is that your baseline for becoming reactive, you know, what the amount of stimulus or the amount of cumulative stimulus that triggers you changes. It starts to become higher. So it takes more of whatever it is to trigger you. That's the first thing. You start noticing that, like, well, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, if my daughter would have said X, or you know, my spouse or my partner would have done Y, you know, I would really be feeling it. And you notice that that's not what's happening. Something's different happening. And then the second thing that starts happening is your ability to recover from your reactivity starts to change. So the length of time, you know, like you get really triggered by something and, you know, I'm not exaggerating. I think all of us have something like this. You know, it happens in, it takes 2 days for us to for it to stop coming back in our mind, or 2 hours. Put whatever figure you want on it. But what happens is your recovery time, where your mind goes back into balance, because this, all of this is about balance. All of these states of mind, as expansive as they sound, are balanced states of mind, and they're informed by equanimity. So the amount of time that it takes for your mind to go back into balance shortens. And then the third thing that happens is that both as a matter of practice, and then after you practice for a certain period of time intuitively, your response after you go back into balance, or maybe right in the beginning, is a different response. You know, rather than getting angry and then having to get back into balance and then say, okay, I'm going to practice some metta. Okay. All of that happens quite quickly, and you intuitively, just intuitively, in response to this, you begin having a kind response, because you begin to see that this other way of living is actually harming you. Harming your nervous system, harming your body, harming your relationships, and hurting other people as well. So, I think in the opening night I talked about, I was on the freeway and there were all the crazy drivers, and I've gotten pretty good with all the crazy driving in the past 4 or 5 years. I've worked on it and I don't get too upset about it, but this one was really frightening. You know, there's some guy who's really, really speeding, and he's going from the first lane to the fourth lane to the first lane, you know, weaving in and out, comes up on top of me, and I can honestly say the idea that he would pull over into my lane, there was so small amount of space, it never even crossed my mind, which was probably part of the problem. And he just, like, pulled right in, and it 70 miles an hour or something, you know, two feet in front of your car feels like it's 2 inches. You know, it's quite an experience, you know. And he was right on the guy in front of him's bumper. And then after I pulled back, he just stayed on that guy's bumper for a couple of miles. Right? So I really was triggered by it. I was really frightened, and it was expressed as anger. And but really quickly, I mean, not immediately, but really quickly, I could just see how completely I was lit up. You know, my breath, my temperature, the tension in my body, the whole thing. And quite quickly, I could just see that my body and my mind were starting to move back into balance intuitively. You know, without my saying, well, I'm gonna calm down, I'm gonna give myself metta. I mean, you could just feel it starting to happen, which wouldn't have happened before. And then once I got back in something close to balance, I have to admit I didn't have an intuitive response of starting to wish him metta. I had to name it and then start to do it. And then once I started to do it, I've done it enough where at some period of time it was no longer like I'm cognitively reframing it. I was actually feeling that, you know, for the guy in front of him and for him and for myself, and being concerned just about the welfare of everybody. So, you know, it's not magic. You just don't practice metta for a week and then suddenly, you know, you're going to have an intuitive response of deep kindness to everybody. But it slowly starts to unfold. And when you see this, it gives you a sense of confidence about yourself and how you will respond to things and handle things. So the first line has to do with We're going to stop for just a second. Okay. So the first, and I think you know, one of the ones that you start to see the earliest has to do with reactivity. The second one has to do with beginning to see other people differently, and see other people differently in the sense of you actually begin to see them as yourself. And what I mean by that is that these practices are practices where we are extending ourselves, we're cultivating an intention to extend ourselves to others and to treat them in a different way, to treat them in an unconditional way. And as you do this, particularly when you do this as an intensive meditative practice, what just quickly becomes unescapable, and you begin to feel this, not think it, but you begin to feel this, is that the people that you were calling up and practicing with, you know, your friend, your mother, your father who passed away, a child, the mailman, the clerk at the grocery store, it doesn't matter who it is, what starts to become clear when you begin to open your heart, when these begin to work, is that you realize that internally they are just like you are, that we are all exactly the same, that the pain and suffering that I feel, the terrible sense of isolation that I feel when I'm suffering or when I'm in self-doubt is exactly the same terrible sense of suffering and isolation that other people feel. And when you actually begin to feel that as opposed to intellectualize it, something starts to happen. And you know, the Dalai Lama talks a lot about this. He says when we don't have this feeling, what we are able to do is treat other people as separate from ourselves, which is what allows us to harm them, you know, or to demonize them, or all the different things that we do. It's the absence of that quality. So, you know, this kind of talk, because we're talking about characteristics of all the Brahma, you know, this could go on. It won't, but it could go on for days, because there's so many things. But with respect to this, there's two things that start to happen. And the first one is that we slowly start to expand the circle of who we're bringing into our circle of care. You know, normally, for most of us, that circle is actually fairly small. You know, people who we have something close to kind of an unlimited sense of care. And even most of those have some conditionality to them. You know, like most committed relationships have an element to them of, you know, I love you and you love me, and part of the reason I love you is that you treat me as the person, a particular person. And if you stop treating me as that person, it starts creating problems in our relationship. So, you know, it happens sometimes when people get on the spiritual path that, you know, one person isn't, the other person is, and one person really starts changing and it threatens the hell out of the other person. Yeah. So, there's a lot of conditionality and attachment in most of our relationships. And so, this is starting to open this up to a larger circle of people and loosening the conditionality and the attachment. And you've probably heard this quotation. This is from Albert Einstein, and it's beautiful in the, you know, when you take it out of context, but for me it becomes really meaningful when you understand the context of this quotation. And so the context for Einstein saying this. And you may know that Einstein was, believed that we had two minds. We had a rational mind and an intuitive mind. And the rational mind was a wonderful servant, but the intuitive mind was where all of our wisdom was. And that in our culture, we had become lost because we got it reversed. We believe that the rational mind should be put first rather than the intuitive mind. And, you know, he said that, you know, all of the great scientific discoveries, that when they first came to him, none of them came to him in a form that you could identify as anything that the rational mind would classify as language or speech. But they came to him as images and feelings, which then eventually got translated. So Einstein had a rabbi approach him whose 16-year-old daughter had been killed. And he asked Einstein how he could explain why his daughter had been killed to his other daughter, who was 19 years old. And the rabbi described the 16-year-old as a young girl who was sinless, beautiful, and a 16-year-old child. And he said, how can I explain this to my other daughter? So that's the context for this, I think, a really beautiful quotation, which is really descriptive of what we're talking about. He says, a human being is a part of a whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He or she experiences themselves, their thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness, exactly what the Dalai Lama is saying, right? This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. So, I mean, that is really the essence of the teaching when we're talking about these mind states being unlimited, unconditional, and unmeasurable, is that that circle just keeps expanding. So the second thing is that you start to feel barriers between yourself and other people start to soften and dissolve rather than be oppositional. So when I said earlier that, you know, that there's a number of relationships which I honestly thought would never heal at all, ever. And in the last 5 or 6 years, have really had some significant transformations in them. And this includes people in our Sangha, my relationship with them, where due to limitations on my part and, unwise action and maybe the same thing on their part, we really hurt each other. But you start this practice and you start to see that you start to feel the origins of this, you know, aren't so personal, that they have to do with two people suffering and being confused about each other's motives and not knowing how to communicate and not trusting each other. And then you keep working with this and then you start to see that more deeply. And as I said, you know, it gives you the courage to be willing to take risks, or at least what you think are risks, you know, emotional risks, that you were fearful to do before. So, you know, the archetypal image of compassion is Kuan Yin. And one of the things I say about Kuan Yin is Kuan Yin hears the voices of all the suffering in the world. This an extraordinary cacophony of suffering, you know, pouring down on you. And what it does not say is that Kuan Yin hears the suffering, the voices of all the suffering in the world, and flinches, or closes her heart, or restricts herself, or tries to protect herself. It's just the reverse. She opens her heart and embraces the suffering of other beings. And so the nature of this is you move from your intuitive response is to restrict, you know, to become rigid, to protect yourself, to open and become flexible and to absorb things. And so suddenly you have the capacity to handle things that you couldn't handle before. You know, what makes it so difficult for us to handle things? You know, when we have self-judgment, self-criticism, when we think we're inadequate, when we have doubt, what happens to us? We start to constrict. You know? We start to feel inadequate. We start to feel like we can't do it. We become afraid. We don't want to take a risk. And so this is just the reverse. It's that intuitively you start seeing that those states of mind are actually hurting you and hurting others because you're not extending yourself to others. And so your response starts to become to open. Now, at the beginning, it's little baby openings. You know, maybe it's so small, it doesn't even look like an open. And then pretty soon, you know, with the right circumstance and the right person, it's like a big opening. And then something really happens as a result of that, that your mind 2 or 3 years before would have never thought you could do. You know, this ordinary little shriveled up mind that we have. Wouldn't believe it. And then you start to realize that there's much more that's possible. I think the next thing, and it relates very closely to this, but it's really a beautiful idea, is that we begin to be committed to, it's actually a learning, but we begin to develop an intention to stay in relationship with others, even if we're in opposition, rather than closing ourselves off, rather than closing the other person off. Because we start seeing, because we know how difficult it is, and we know how painful it feels to be closed off by somebody else. We know how painful that is. So that we begin to see that part of the key to having a lasting, deep, caring, productive relationships is this ability actually to stay in relationship regardless of what's going on. Doesn't matter who's angry, who's hurt, you do not shut the door. And I think the person who really said it beautifully is Sri Ramakrishna, who was, you know, a great Indian saint Hindu, and he said, do whatever you will with another person, but never put them out of your heart. It is such a powerful statement, you know. So these are just some of the things, but they're, to me, extraordinary things because they really are transformative. In Brahma Vihara, Vihara meaning dwelling or abode, and Brahma meaning God or Godhead. So these are frequently called the divine abodes or the divine dwellings. And they're called that precisely because they're so potentially transformational. That's the reason that kind of specific language is used. Okay. So there's just one more thing, and so this one that may or may not work, but it's true. Okay, so we have been doing this last year. We have had a year-long course called "How Can I Help?" And it's a course about service. And so, to be in the course, you had to commit to doing a certain amount of service in the community every month. And there are readings from a book by Ram Dass and Paul Gorman, and then by Joanna Mason. And I think what people are starting to see is that I think a lot of people signed up thinking the course was about service. Meaning, like, service out there in the community or something. And have ended up seeing that that's not what the course is really about. The course is about service in the sense of service to ourselves and everyone around us. It's about relationship and how kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity are fundamental and transform relationship. So when these practices start to work, we start getting these little glimpses that there's something much bigger going on here than anything that we ever suspected. And in you know, Buddhist language, we're talking about everything being conditional and everything being interconnected and interrelated. And there's this image of what they call Indra's net, where everything in the universe is all linked. And so you actually begin to have a sense that that's true. I mean, it's so big that I don't think our rational mind can. You can have an idea, you can paint a picture of it, but feeling that, you can't do that with your rational mind. Okay, so you start having glimpses that, you know, I'm looking at you and you're looking at me, but there's something beyond that that's linking both of us. That there is, you know, at least for me, it's still a pretty big mystery that we're sitting on the Earth right now in an unfathomable large universe. And somehow you start getting an inkling of this connection that makes that understandable, not in a rational way, but in a heart way, of how deeply we're connected. And when you start to touch that place, it begins to just change your understanding about everything, about what you're doing and the value of it and who you think you are and what relationships are and the value of this little planet that we're living on. And so I think it's hard to find anything at all that even gets close to describing this. And I feel like really inadequate at this part of the talk. But I'm going to read a quotation to you, which is a little bit longer, and it uses some language we don't normally use. So it talks about God and what have you. So just translate that, because for years I studied with Ram Dass, and Ram Dass doesn't believe that there's any clockwork God out there, and as a Hindu, doesn't even, and I think most people who have gone deep into the practice, that actually Hinduism and our practice are pretty close together in the end. You know, how we get there is different, but ultimately the idea that there's something far beyond our rational mind that we can't put in a box, and it's a mystery. So this is one way that we start helping to be able to understand it. So he says, these practices open us up to an awareness within ourself which is itself unitive. That these states of mind themselves have to do with unity. Okay. Not only do we see and hear more, but our very openness and spaciousness begins to dissolve opposition and discord with others. Through these practices and our efforts to keep our hearts open in the presence of suffering, we find ourselves more available to whoever we are with. Compassion is increasingly an automatic response. We find a deep quality of love infusing our actions with others, the expression of this love in turn becomes increasingly our goal. Whatever the circumstance, the more unconditionally we share it, the more helpful it is to all of us. This is the essence of the spiritual path of devotional service. One enters into the helping act not only because there is a need to be met. Service gradually becomes an offering, first to those we are with, but eventually to that greater truth or source of being in which we are all joined in unconditional love. Helping becomes an act of reverence, of worship, of gratitude. It is grace merely to have the chance to serve another human being. Mother Teresa, for example, bending to hold a dying leper, sees that there is only, quote, Christ in a distressing disguise, close quote. She's not helping a dying leper. She's loving God, affirming in whoever she's with universal qualities of beauty and perfection. One can imagine how it might feel to be held in this spirit during one final moments on this earth. The Hindu deity Hanuman, Ram Dass's favorite symbolic god, offers a similar example of devotional service. Every act he performs becomes an offering to Ram. His service brings him to the very edge of unitive life. How powerful his vision, quote, when I know who I am you, close quote, he says, kneeling before Ram, quote, when I don't know who I serve you, close quote. For both of these inspirational figures and for any of us, the smallest act of caring, making a sick friend's bed, filling a bowl of rice on a food line, welcoming a stranger, comforting a frightened friend, can be a means of affirming the greater unity of life in love. So, in the end, the Buddhist vision of liberation has to do with eventually uprooting all aversive states of qualities of mind and having them replaced with these qualities of mind, so that this idea of every act is an act of service. It's an act of service to ourselves. It's an act of service to whoever we're serving. It's an act to all of us, because we're all interconnected, and that begins to inform everything we do. Okay, so how is this possible? Why would it happen? And there's two answers. The first one is that you can hear from the nature of these qualities of mind that they create a sense of spaciousness and a sense of emotional expansiveness that allows us to hold things that we aren't normally able to hold. Okay, so the Buddha, to try to explain this, said, let's take a quantum of salt, a lump of salt, put it in a glass of water, just a little glass of water, put it in there, stir it up, okay? Try to drink it. You know, it's going to be miserable. Okay? Take that same chunk of salt, put it in a river or in a lake that's clean, and then drink that water, and you'll hardly even notice it. Okay. So kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity begin to be the base that is holding what we see in our Vipassana work. You know, we see these really, if we don't have that base, things that feel quite brutal. You know, we see our inadequacies, we see our shortfalls, we realize that we hurt somebody and never knew that we hurt somebody. We realize how deeply we've hurt ourselves. We realize how emotionally cut off we are. These are really painful things. But as we practice the Brahma Viharas, the self-judgmental and self-critical voice starts to calm down. So these things can come up, and then rather than being reactive to them and trying to push them away or wall them off, we do what Kuan Yin does, is that we open to them and that we start to work with them in a new way. So that's the first reason that these other things can actually happen. The second reason is, in a way, kind of mechanistic, but it's one we all know, that reactivity has a very specific way that it rolls out from a Buddhist perspective. You know, we have desire aversion, it moves up to attachment, the mind starts contracting, we go into identification, and then we're just lost, right? We're unconscious. We hurt ourselves, we hurt other people. So what happens is that this intervenes, and it slows down, disrupts, and in many cases eliminates that whole reactive process. So once again, this serves as the base both in internally working with very deep material, whether it's in meditation or whether it's just personally reflecting or it's working with a therapist, and in our relationships with other people. There's this whole new base that informs everything. So, okay. So, there's two practices. One is practicing this as a form of meditation, intensive meditation, and the other one is in relationship. Okay, so as a meditation practice, it's important to realize that all of these, all four of them, are what are considered concentration practices. Concentration practices have very specific characteristics. Characteristic is that we put our attention on something and hold it there to the exclusion of other things. So if we were sitting in meditation doing Vipassana, we're sitting here, we're focusing on our breath, and something else comes up. Our mind goes to that, and if it's stronger than the primary object, we stay with that, right? If there's pain in our knee or strong emotion that's expressing itself in our body. With these, with concentration practice, we are focused almost entirely on, in the traditional way that you do it, a repetition of phrases where you're trying to evoke this intentional emotional feeling. May you be safe and protected. May you be peaceful and happy. May you be free from suffering. You're trying to actually well that up in yourself and express that and then cultivate it. Okay? So that is done over and over again. And the only reason that you break away from that is that if you begin to notice that you're doing something that is that other than that. Okay, so you realize that rather than being equanimous about it, even though there may be a strong feeling about it, that you think you're doing compassion or metta, and you notice that you're angry. Okay? So you either switch to another person, or you switch to Vipassana. Or the reverse of that, you know, you're doing metta, which is supposed to be this open kindness, and you suddenly know that what you're really doing is you're really attached. You know, you're holding on rather than trying to cultivate the intention of may you be free from suffering, may you be safe. You've clamped down and you're actually wanting that to happen in the person's life. Okay? So that's no longer cultivating metta, it's you're caught in attachment. So one way is an intensive practice, and it's indispensable because just like Vipassana, the reason we do this is that we go to a depth in a retreat like this that we can't do in any other way, or at home in a community practice. We sit because it creates a bank account, a reserve, a well of wisdom, or these states of mind. So it's indispensable. Second way that we practice it is in relationship. So here, it could be as simple as, you know, we're outside and you're at the food line. And, you know, you see somebody come in and they're really rushing and they're kind of anxious and what have you. You just step back and you let them go in front of you. Just the simplest act of kindness. You know, you see that somebody is struggling with something and you just allow them to go in the food line ahead of you. And then in daily life, when we leave here, you know, the opportunities are endless. You know, we start with, we're in relationship with somebody, and it doesn't have to be a reason. It doesn't have to be that somebody, you know, it's unconditional in the sense that we're not kind to somebody in this tradition because it's unconditional. We're not kind to somebody because we think they need it or deserve it. We're kind because kindness transforms relationships. So pick somebody out. Joseph Goldstein always tells this story about there was a boy when he was in India, and he would come and Joseph would put his fruit up on this window, and there were no screens. And this little Indian boy would come and steal his fruit. And so he just started doing metta for this little kid, you know, like, he doesn't know what it is, you know, whether he's, you know, just a little truant or whether he's not getting enough to eat. It doesn't matter, you know. So he just starts doing this metta. He doesn't see him for like 10 days, you know. And then he sees him, and he says his internal reaction was just like to light up. He was so happy to see this little boy, you know. So there's, you know, endless opportunities where it starts off as cognitively framing something, okay? You know, you see somebody at the store, you know, the checker or what have you, and he's okay, and then you're just being kind to them, or you're actually repeating the phrases at the cash register. You know, I'll frequently do that. You know, talking to whoever the clerk is, you know, just looking them right in the eye. You know, you're talking about something, and you're thinking, may you be safe and protected. You know, may you be happy. It sounds crazy, and it's amazing when you start doing this regularly. What it does for you. And I'm sure Rich and Diane will share experiences with you along this line. So, in a very broad sense, those are the two big categories of how we can practice. I want to close with an unlikely candidate for a closing quotation, but I'd like you to listen to how closely this quotation is to what I've been talking about, and then the quotation from Einstein. Okay, about this expanding. And this is kind of taking it the next step. And for me, it shows that these states of mind have played an important and revered role in almost every historical religion and indigenous cultures in particular. So this is from Black Elk, who's an Oglava, a medicine man, and through a translator, this book was published called Black Elk Speaks, which you may have heard of. It's really kind of a gorgeous book. So he says, then I was standing on the highest mountain of them all, and round about beneath me was the whole hoop of the world. So, you know, he's speaking metaphorically here. Okay. And while I stood there, I saw more than I could tell, and I understood more than I saw. And while I stood there, I saw more than I could tell, and I understood more than I saw. For I was seeing, in a sacred way, the shapes of all things in the spirit, and the shape of all shapes as they must live together like one being. And I saw that the sacred hoop of my people was one of many hoops that made one circle. Wide as daylight and as starlight. And in the center grew a mighty flowering tree to shelter all the children of one mother and one father. And I saw that it was holy. And in our tradition, we would call that one mighty flowering tree, the Dharma. So let's just sit for a few minutes.